Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. First things first, well, we don't have a quorum, do we?
No.
1, 2, 3. Okay, well, we'll hold off. If staff could let me know we have a quorum so we don't forget to take care of that. We'll be continuing our discussion of what we had in the previous committee hearing, which is an overview of education finance. Mr. Strom, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crow and myself are back again today. We're going to run through some additional topics on school funding. We're going to finish up our PowerPoint presentation. We're going to spend a little time talking about how the aid and levy worksheet looks, and then we're going to go on and look at the school finance printout.
Mr.
Strom. That's where we're going to start. I think when we left off, we were about on page 30. Let's get us there here.
Mr. Strom, while you're doing that, Representative Bills has thoroughly reviewed the minutes and moves adoption of the minutes from January 11th. Is there any discussion, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Mr. Strom. Otherwise, if anyone on the committee has any items for discussion they'd like to bring up, now might be the appropriate time. Or not. Obviously, the majority leader has made it into the room. Do you have anything for us, Mr. Majority Leader?
Is this taxes?
That's one kind of tax.
No, it's not, Mr. Majority Leader.
I can say I'm happy to see the flagpole has been removed.
Oh.
In the last committee meeting.
Oh, yes.
Well, actually, that
was in the basement.
Representative Peterson, that was down in the basement.
Oh, okay.
And we should...
Well, nonetheless, there's none.
We should have a flag in here.
Yeah, the Majority Leader should know that we just about lost one or two members of the Majority Caucus from the flagpole falling in the basement on them today. So
it's on the wrong side of the room, as it is.
So
flag is always on the left when you're facing.
Yeah. So
a U.S. flag. That was the Minnesota State flag, I believe. That was correctly placed.
Representative Erickson, we have anything we want to talk about with the committee while we're waiting for Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom to get online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of requests. I would like to find out what it costs the state of Minnesota to participate in all federal programs. If we could get I prefer to have it broken down into the areas of funding that come from the feds, but at least a total figure, and then maybe we could do a cost-benefit analysis.
Good idea. Mr. Solem, do you think we could work with staff and try to arrange that data? Their technologies are tied up right now, so. Anything else, Representative Erickson?
Well, then I was looking at the education finance print out that we have, and is it on lines 122 versus 123, the general ed, are the forecasted amounts going up because of increase in compensatory, do you think?
Representative Erickson, I'm not looking at the spreadsheet, but I'm going off of memory of what staff has shared with me, is as the economy's been under more stress, more people are qualifying for the free and reduced lunch count. So that's a driver. But also, as the concentration goes up, we're seeing an increase in that as well. So, for example, we should not look at that and assume that there is a, and I'm going off the top of my head here, a 15% increase in the amount of qualifying individuals. It's rather a combination of those two factors.
Yes.
In addition to that, school enrollment in Minnesota is going up. But as always, we'd want to consult staff. But I think the three biggest drivers that you would see in that are the compensatory count going up, concentration going up, and then school enrollment going up. Those three factors would be the big drivers. Also, and I don't know if this gets carried in the right accounts, but for the equalizing factors that we're using, you know, property values have been going down.
Yes.
And those are not adjusted for inflation upward or downward. So as more people and more school districts are qualifying for the equalization formula, we're actually seeing increases in expenditures on that side of things. But I don't know. I'm not looking at the spreadsheet you are, so I would have to. But I think those would all be significant cost drivers. But it looks like Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom are ready. Maybe you could answer the question.
Well, Mr. Chair, kind of exactly the opposite, but you're right on the property tax issue. Property values are going up, which drives more districts off of the formula, so there's less spending on property tax equalization aid because the formulas, the equalizing factors aren't indexed. So in other words, a district that has, if the equalizing factor is $2,000 per pupil unit of property value, if the district's at $1,000 per pupil unit, their 50% aid, 50% levy. If their value goes up to $1,500 per pupil unit, and the equalizing factor stays at 2,000, then their mix of aid and levy is 75% levy and 25% aid.
But Mr. Crow, the spreadsheet that represented—maybe I'm not looking at the spreadsheet—but property values did go down. So when property values were going down, that's why the expenditures are going up.
Mr. Chair, I thought we were talking more long term than what Representative Erickson
just
was looking.
Just don't want you to point me out being wrong.
So I was right when I said you were right.
That's right. Good job.
You were correct when you said he was wrong.
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But also in that same vein, as enrollment declines, those numbers change, and then the equalization also decreases, correct?
Mr. Chair, enrollment, Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, enrollment changes have an influence on property value. If property value is the same and enrollment goes down, the value for our calculations goes up. And so that reduces the amount of aid that a district has. So yeah, a district, at the current time things are kind of working toward opposite each other. But if you have declining enrollment at the same time property values are going up, then districts kind of have a multiplying effect because of the enrollment change on their value for pupil.
Sorry, you have to sit for me.
Be a good opportunity for everyone to shut off their ready. And is there any other questions before we begin with the presentation?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Gentlemen, is it only through our county and school district that we can find out specifically which levies that are not voter approved are in place and to what extent they do levy on those special levies, you know, whether they go to the max, which I'm sure they do, but is that the only way we can get that information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we have that information. That information, there's things called levy reports that are on the Department of Education's website, and they're very long and kind of complicated to read through because all of the calculations that go into the certification and how much is aid and levy and all the pupil counts, and, you know, so they can be 30, 40 pages long. But that information is available to you, and if you want, we can get that for you if you have either a particular levy you're interested in or a particular school district. We can let you know what the situation is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And otherwise, gentlemen, is it better to call the school district or the county?
Mr. Straub, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, why don't you start with Mr. Crow and myself, and then we're happy, if we can't find that, we're happy to call the district for you. Generally speaking, on those levy forms, those are prepared by the district personnel, and we're just finishing up the pay 2011 levy season, so we'll have the certified levies by district in just a week or so, and we can put a little list together for you showing each district, or showing at least summary information for each district. As Mr. Crow says, with 330-some school districts and about 25 levy categories, it's a lot of data, and so the way we present that is we'll try and find a helpful way to do that for you. But start first with us, because we've usually got access to that data.
Representative Erickson? Yeah. And just before I recognize your Representative Bills, Mr. Crow and Mr. Straub, I know that there's a spreadsheet that you sent me before that allows members to enter in a school district number, and it automatically populates the fields in there and gives very specific data on individual districts. I know it has to be updated every year, but perhaps that'd be a good idea to share with the members of the committee that spreadsheet.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we're going to go through a whole variety of spreadsheets, obviously, with you this session. And as an example, the one we'll use today will show you how those selections can work for a legislative district to show data. We can also do that for a school district to show a whole page of data for that school district. And those often, Mr. Crow and myself, refer to those as lookup tables.
Good.
In terms of the Representative Erickson's question about compensatory, you had asked for this at the end of the last meeting. This is the memo to you summarizing the email that Mr. Crow and I sent you about changes in education funding last biennium to this biennium and what explains the difference. And there's a couple of charts in there, and we'll go through that a little later. We want to sort of pick up where we started, but that's what the memo that was just being passed about is. One other bookkeeping detail before we get going here. There was some conversation about price indexes last time. We've put an information brief in your folders about information briefs, so you should have something called using price indexes in your folder as well, and that should explain to you probably more details than you want to know about price indexes.
Thank you. And Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strawn, Mr. Coe, there was a new spreadsheet in the packet today. It said revised January 12th. Is that a new spreadsheet? Or I remember something from Tuesday about a possible discrepancy, and I just want to know, should I toss the other one, or is this a new one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, yes, toss the old one. There were two errors that were found. One was the listing on here when we matched up, when we used our new trick to match up legislative district numbers. We were losing the last legislator for each district and popping him into the wrong place. So the very last column had, for some of the districts, had inaccurate district numbers. We've got that fixed. And then the other thing is that something Representative Downey pointed out to us, when we compare over time with our system of school funding changing, sometimes we need to handle an element that didn't used to exist in a different way. And one of those elements is on the special education front. We now have a statewide process for figuring the net tuition billing between districts. And that net tuition billing was not being netted out on the grand total. So we've reprinted this for fiscal year 12, so that last column, grand total, is also different. And the reason it's different is because we're just looking at 1 year, we can actually factor in that tuition reduction. So I think that'll give you a little clearer printout. It's all the same information, but we're just trying to crowd the columns in differently. And so we've given you a slightly different grand total that will line up so that if you were to add the columns all the way across, you'd get that grand total.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Mr. Chair, if I could, just one more thing. Thank you, Mr. Strom, for the informational brief. And just to let you guys know, I did assign a homework assignment for the weekend for my advanced placement macroeconomics kids, because this perfectly coincides with our curriculum. They will be doing posters over the weekend on difference between CPI and GDP deflator, and I thought that I could bring them in and you guys could judge. I did tell them that the best one would be posted in my office, so maybe I could bring them in and you guys could look at them. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fantastic.
I might get it after this.
Any other questions prior to us starting?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for this. I didn't read my minutes quite closely enough. It says that I was present on Tuesday. I was not. I was back home with the governor. And so just a correction on the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I apologize.
Any other questions before we continue? Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow?
Members, we were on shifts, which starts on page 34 of your PowerPoint. I had done a presentation last year on shifts, and we put this little chart together to sort of graphically walk you through, and it's beautiful, isn't it? No, it's just the start. So to walk you through how a shift happens graphically, and I think if we go one. What? Oh, beep. Okay, so basically it shows for each year, if we're paying at a 90-10 rate, we're paying 100% each year. So you can see in fiscal 09, we have 90% and 10% follow-up payment, and then fiscal 10, 90 and 10, 90 and 10. And so then the next change, I'm not saying beep every time, is when you convert to 80-20, and we're going to show in this example for the middle 2 years for fiscal 10 and fiscal 11. So what happens when you do that is you have an 80% payment in fiscal 10. And so you can see that that's obviously lower than 90%. But we need to pick up the 10% that's at the top of the 90% column for the final payment from the previous year. So the colors sort of go together, the light red, or the pink in the first column goes with the dark red final payment, the light blue, and then the dark blue in the third column, and then the greens go together. So you can see that that for fiscal 10, the actual payment then is 10% lower than it would be with the other payment schedule. So then you go to fiscal, so then that amount, that difference highlighted with the bracket there, is the amount of savings to the state, even though the school districts seeing 100%.
I'm confused as to where we're at. Could someone please direct me so I can follow along?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dietrich, it's just on the slide. This was a different presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I happen to have, so
okay, can you
I thought it might be helpful.
I'll pay attention to the slide.
Okay.
I was thumbing through everything. Sorry.
So sorry. I would have had to print like a bunch of them, and you'd have to do flips if I had printed it. So anyway. So that little bracket there is the amount of savings you get in fiscal 10 when you start a shift. And so then in fiscal 11, You continue to pay that 80%, but then the final payment from, you know, at from 10, where you kind of have the blue going together, is 80%, and then 20% in fiscal 11 to make the final payment. So you're back to the same amount of money then in fiscal 11. And then the next year, if you go back to a 90-10 payment schedule, so now we're working our way where we're going to pay off the shift in fiscal 12. So then we have another 90% payment. We go back up from 80, but the green cap there of 20% that goes back to the 80% in fiscal 11 brings the total payment up above. And there's another little bracket. That's the cost of the state to repay the shift. So those, if you kind of go from the top to the bottom in the matching color by year, you see that you can see the school district is always getting 100% of what they're entitled to, but the state is paying a little less when the shift is instituted in fiscal 10, and then paying a little more in fiscal 12 when it repays the shift. I think that's it on that. So that's how the aid payment shift works, and that's described in more detail in that Money Matters that we passed out. And again, it goes back to how.
Excuse me, Mr. Crow. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You're saying the schools always get 100%, but that first year in 010, they're losing 10%, correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Crow.
What happens?
Yeah.
So these blue sections are the amount that the district sees. So in fiscal 09, or the matching color, so in fiscal 09, they get 90% of what they're owed for 09, and then 10% in 10 for what they're owed for 09. So the kind of the colors go with the fiscal year. So in 10, when you go to 80-20, they get 90 here and 10 here. When you shift to 80-20, they get 80 and 20. So they're always getting 100%. It's just the state here is only paying 90% because we're paying 80 for this year and then 10 that goes back with the previous year.
Mr. Crow, I think I speak legislator. I can translate. I think what's happening is that what Mr. Crow is saying is they always get the 100% when they pay back the shift.
Yeah.
I think that's the point that's being... No, because what happens is when you do the initial shift,
the first year,
that's where your one-time cost savings comes from. However, in terms of getting that money, getting that savings, it shows up in the next fiscal year. So what Mr. Crow is talking about is the entitlement versus the appropriation. But in terms of truing up, getting the appropriations on track, that doesn't take place until you pay back the shift. Does that make sense, Representative Anderson?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and right. Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that the 90% that the district sees in cash flow that year is what they have to use for cash flow. They don't count that as their revenue. They always count the 100% as their revenue for that year. So in other words, they don't cut their budget by 10% in the year that we institute the shift because they're still counting on the full 100%. Now, it may mean that they have to spend down the reserves or borrow to make up for the fact that they're not going to get that 10% of the money until the fall of the next fiscal year. But they still do their books and their budget as if they're getting the full 100% in that current fiscal year, not when they actually get the check from the state.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, just to reiterate, it's because they're on an accrual accounting system, and they're putting the colors together here. If they're getting that 80% in fiscal year 10, they've already booked the 20% they're going to get in fiscal year 11. That's revenue for them. So that light blue and that dark blue are what the school districts see. So the shift doesn't matter for the school district's revenue on their books, but it matters greatly for the state because the state is only cash-based in its accounting. And so in that fiscal year 10 in the second blue and red bar there, the state's only paying out the 90%. So the state gets savings, but the school district's going to recognize both halves of the blue there, the 80 and the 20%. And so the school district's going to recognize the full 100%. So it's only a cash flow issue for the schools. It's not a revenue issue. It's just a cash flow issue for the schools.
And before we, I just want to take a look around the committee. Do the members of the committee fully understand this? It's an important distinction to understand when we're dealing with forecast appropriations and assumptions. Is there any other questions before we move on to the next item? Okay. Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
And Mr. Chair and members, just... The current landscape is going into the previous biennium, we were at a 90-10 payment schedule. For fiscal 10, the legislature adopted a 73-27% schedule, and for fiscal 11, a 70-30 payment schedule. So we're paying 70% in the current year, 30% in the subsequent fiscal year. But that was adopted on a limited basis. So for fiscal 12, under current law, the payment schedule goes back to 90-10. And so when we look at an appropriations spreadsheet, you'll see for 10 and 11 that the payments are pretty low. There's some savings. And then for fiscal 12, there's a significant jump in school funding compared to fiscal 11 because we're paying back that shift on this particular payment shift. And then the other shift is the property tax shift. I think we talked about that. Basically, it's requiring districts to recognize most of their June collection of property taxes in the fiscal year that's ending that year versus the fiscal year that's starting in July. And then the other shift that we didn't get to is that during a fiscal year, if the state has cash flow problems, then the state can choose to delay payments within the fiscal year to school districts. So the state makes payments every other week to school districts. And what this allows is if the state isn't collecting enough money in a given month, for example, we can reduce, the Commissioner of Finance or MMB can reduce payments to school districts and just has to pay them back by May 30th is what the statute says. So within a fiscal year, basically the state can borrow from school districts by withholding payments and then paying them off at the end of the school year. Doesn't result in any state savings because it all happens within the same fiscal year. So over the course of the fiscal year, the state pays the same amount of money. For school districts, they're still getting the payments in the same fiscal year. But again, it can contribute to cash flow problems for school districts because they don't get their money in some cases a couple of months or 6 months after they were originally intended to get it. This provision has been in law for about 20 or 30 years. It wasn't used the first time until last spring when the state started really experiencing significant cash flow issues. And again, this fall, the state is delaying about $140 million of payments to schools between September of this year and April, or September of last fall and April of this spring, until the May 30th school payment. So districts are having some money held back right now to help the state with its cash flow issues.
Mr. Crow, I remember last session there was a discussion regarding the statute says the commissioner of MMB must do that, and we talked about changing it to May. Did we pass that into law or not?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, there were two changes made to the statute that deals with this issue. Basically, the trigger for whether it kicked in was if the state had cash flow issues, then the commissioner was required to withhold payments in order to prevent the state from doing short-term borrowing. That provision was changed to be permissive, to allow them but not require them to make these to withhold payments from districts. The other change was in the in previous law, there was a minimum. Basically, only money is only withheld from districts that have fund balances, and the threshold for how much you had to have before the state would withhold funding from you was raised to $700 per pupil. So if you don't have a fund balance at least that high, then the state doesn't withhold payments from you during the course of the year.
Any additional questions for Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom on either of these items? Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, we're going to try and get through the rest of the PowerPoint pretty quickly for you. We wanted to talk a little about referendum elections. If you're on 35 of the PowerPoint that's in your packets, and it's also up on the screen, you can see that for the last decade, the number of referendum questions that were asked is listed, as well as the millions of dollars of authority that was requested. And then the second to last column shows the amount actually approved by the taxpayers and a percent approval rating at the end. I think this is just important for you to keep in mind. You're going to have a lot of bills related to the referendum this year. A lot of the school funding has become fairly dependent on referendums, and so that's why we've got this chart included in your packets. The next chart just shows the change of the basic formula allowance plus the referendum and equity revenue over time. This is a measure that's required by statute, perhaps not the best measure of disparity in school funding, but you can see with the referendum plus the basic and the equity money that the gap between those that were getting the most and those that were getting the least on these measures was going down through the 1990s, and in the 2000s now has started to pick up again, and you can see that's increased a bit. There's other ways to measure that gap that Mr. Crow and I prefer a little better than this one, but this is the one in statute that's required for the department to issue a report on each year. The next thing we'd like to talk about is special education revenue. We're not going to get into the formulas today, but we just want to remind the committee members of why special education is always close to the surface when this committee is discussing its school finance decisions. We define a term in statute called the special education cross subsidy, and what this essentially means is it's the amount that our revenue formulas from the state and federal government are short compared to the amount of expenditures that school districts have for special education services. This chart is in millions of dollars and starts in 1999. And you can see using the methodology that the statute sets up, in 1999, the amount of revenue that school districts got for special education programs was $352 million less than the amount of expenditures that the districts had for that program. And you can see over time that that amount increased pretty dramatically. And in fact, if you look at 2002, as some of the budget actions taken in 2001 when there was a smaller recession, the legislature eliminated the growth rates in special education revenue. And you can see that what happened when those growth rates were eliminated was that there was a fairly dramatic climb in the amount of that special education difference between expenditures and revenue. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have a difference between expenditures and revenue if there's other funds, other general fund money a district has. There may be some very good reasons for having a formula that doesn't 100% reimburse the cost that school districts face for special education.
Mr. Strom, just really quickly, are those growth factors completely eliminated from statute now? And the second part is, if they're not, what are the growth factors right now?
Mr. Chair, members, the growth factors were reinstated about 5 or 6 years ago. And you can see on the chart for 2007 that there was some pretty dramatic ones put in place for 4 years' time. And then starting in fiscal year 12, we're back to a relatively small growth factor that's an ongoing growth factor in the special ed formula. It's one of the few formulas in the K-12 area that actually has any growth built into it. The basic formula allowance, for example, is set as a flat amount, and there's not an inflator or a growth factor set into it. In special education, there is. So those growth factors were reinstated. But starting in fiscal year 2012, they're going to be a little lower than they were through the 4 years previous to that, and that's part of why the shape of that curve changes there.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, the percent, Mr. Crow reminds me, the percent for the regular special education is 4.6% per year, and the second special education formula, which is called the excess cost formula, is 2%.
4.6 and 2%, 2% being the excess cost one.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, you're presenting what I would assume are dollar figures here. Mm-hmm. Is this consistent across the state that each district experiences this equally and therefore this is the dollar figure to rely on, or does it vary by district?
Mr. Chair, Strong. Representative Dabney's reading ahead. If we go to the next slide.
you would be the first instructor who's ever observed that about me.
And Mr. Strom, my guess is probably the last.
That's true as well.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to display this data in any number of ways for you. We do have the cross-subsidy data by school district, and so we're happy to group it in any number of ways. We've made sort of an arbitrary grouping here. We've put Minneapolis and St. Paul together, and then the other metropolitan school districts in a category, and then we've grouped the greater Minnesota districts by size. There are great differences in Greater Minnesota depending on the nature of the school district on the cross subsidies, and primarily what we find is that those that have are sort of considered regional centers, St. Cloud being the one that's most affected by this, that the relative cross subsidy, the amount that the expenditures are exceeding the revenue in a district like St. Cloud is just about as large as it is in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Other regional centers have that as well. So we'll break that down in a different way besides just on size. But you can see here that if you break those subsidies down or that cross-subsidy down by size, you can see that there's a pretty dramatic difference among school districts. Again, this is data we've got several years of history with, and we're happy to give you a district-by-district run on it. And we're happy to sort that any number of ways so you can see how your districts compare to others. You can see here, though, other than the center cities, if we just group on size, there's not a whole lot of difference on that cross-subsidy, but that really masks what's going on by type of district. And what we generally find for the small districts, particularly a small district that may have a very expensive special education population, often has extremely high costs. Those can vary from year to year, of course. And then otherwise, the regional centers in Greater Minnesota tend not to look like the rest. So this chart probably isn't the best way to show that data, but there is a lot of variation by district in this cross-subsidy.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, could you just one more time for me define that number on page 37, say in 1990? I think you said this is the number where your revenues exceed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, what we do to define this cross-subsidy is we look at the total amount of revenue that the school district gets for special education purposes. We take the federal revenue and essentially wash it out against the federal expenditures. And then what remains, we take the state revenue and we offset some of the general education revenue. We presume a portion of the general education revenue is available for special education purposes. And then the remainder is the gap. And that gap we refer to as the cross subsidy. So after we've allocated a portion of the general ed money to the category of special ed expenditures, then you can see that for fiscal 99, the expenditures the districts made were $352 million greater than the revenue that was available to them for that program. And so they had $352 million cumulatively across all school districts that they had to find from a different source in order to fund their special education programs. And as you go across by year in that graph, if you see you get to fiscal year 2007, we're up to $599 million that districts needed to take from their other general fund money in order to balance their special education budgets. And then you can see from there how that's gone out. We're happy to get into the details on that methodology. The Department of Education actually calculates the cross subsidy in two different ways. They use, depending on how much of the general ed money they allocate. There's some good reasons to look at both of those ways, but the one that they call the net cross subsidy is the one that I think most districts look at, and this is that net cross subsidy after some of the general education revenue's been applied.
Representative Bills, any follow up at all?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strom, maybe just an observation, but I'd like your comments on it. This seems like an odd relationship. Is it just the way we deliver special education services to that we don't allow for any economies of scale, or there's really nothing built into our mandates and things that allows for that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, there's a couple of things going on in the special education area that have some big effects, and let me highlight a few of those. One is that we certainly have a very unequal distribution of special education students throughout the state. Particularly the children with the highest needs tend to be in places that are often going to have medical needs as well, so they tend to be in places where they can get their other needs met as well. So one thing that we have going on is that we have sort of an unequal grouping of where special education students are located. A second thing that we have is we have an open enrollment system in Minnesota, and one of our ways of handling open enrollment bills for special education purposes, the resident district is always the district on the hook, whether a student goes from open enrollment to one district or another or to a charter school. And so some schools are going to receive a fair amount of billbacks because they have students from other schools that are enrolled in other schools. And depending on those levels of billbacks, that can make a great deal of difference as well. There's two school districts in the Western Metro area, probably not important to name them, that have a perpetual battle about special education because one of the districts feels it offers very much a Chevrolet program, a program where they've really tried to control costs, and what they find, or at least what they argue they find, is that a lot of their students choose to open enroll in the other district. The other district provides a more generous and broader special education program in some people's minds, and then they can bill back any unfunded costs to the resident district. And so the district claims that, well, gee, we're losing because of that. And issues there, you know, are repeated elsewhere. There may be a reason why one district is serving a lot of special ed but billing the kids, billing back for other areas. There are some definite economies of scale that we see, but there aren't any real consistent trends that I would say. I'd say that, you know, center cities and regional centers tend to generally have higher special ed costs, and then randomly, or what appears to be random patterns on some of these very small districts where they may have a child who needs $50,000 or $70,000 worth of services a year, you'll see on a per pupil basis that will really, really pull them up. I'd be happy for the next hearing, or I can even run up and print that off now if you like. We could print off a printout district by district so you could see how these districts vary, because there really is quite a bit of variation from district to district on this front.
Representative Kelly?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. We can move on. I appreciate your comments.
And Mr. Strom, maybe what we could do is just email that out to the committee members. No reason to take you away. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Kelly asked most of my question. The other I had was on the cross-subsidy school districts from various other streams of money they may receive, or is most of it coming from their basic per pupil formula, or how are they compensating
Mr.
for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, some school districts argue that they're having to pass their referendums in part to fund their unfunded special education costs. Others are just taking it from their general fund, from their basic per pupil money. It's a little bit of a semantical argument about where that money is going to come from, because it really is all coming from their other general operating money, and that money is a little bit fungible. So, but I think one of the biggest complaints you'll hear from local school board members is that their special ed costs are making them reach into the funds for other that they would otherwise have available for other programs.
Representative Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw.
Withdraw from what?
My question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, what is the impact of the cooperative effort with education districts on the cost of providing special education? And then also, what is the prevalence in the areas for those districts versus districts that are in similar size and demographics in that delivery?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, there's a variety of models, as you're familiar with, that school districts use for special education services. In the metro area here, there's something called intermediate school districts that provide a great deal of collaborative special education programming. In some parts of greater Minnesota, the service cooperatives, what used to be called EXUs, provide that function. And in other areas, there are cooperative groups of districts that get together to provide special ed services. I'm not aware of any information that would suggest any of those groups are more efficient or less efficient than another way of doing it. But to the extent that the membership in these organizations is voluntary, my guess is that the members do find that they're getting efficiencies of scale by being members of special education cooperatives.
Representative Kwan?
So do you have any, can you provide some data offline on the different various ways?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to give you some information about what districts do cooperative programming on special education. And we could try, and I haven't, you know, it's a good question. I haven't looked at trying to group those and see if there are differences. I'm not sure what we'd use as a control in some ways, because each of our school district situations is so differently. But we'll get you those groupings, and we can think about maybe whether there's some way to compare that data.
And Representative Kwan, Mr. Strom, as always, please email the committee if possible, unless it's so all members are well informed. Anything else, Representative Kwan? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, a couple of questions. You said that you have the breakdown by district on those things. Would that breakdown also include the number of students that they serve, so that you would wind up with some sort of a per pupil cost?
Mr. Chair, we could put the breakdown that's on the web that the department has shows it per total student count and not just per special education student count. We could put that number on there, but what we find is that special education students are a very different category by type of disability. So you may have a relatively larger number of students who are receiving, say, an hour or two of speech therapy a week in one district, and in another district you may have a severely disabled child. And so your numbers of special ed kids, cost divided by number of participants in the program, isn't a real good measure. And we don't have district level data by type of, by hours of service by district. We certainly have district level data, and I can pop some of these charts up by, or state level data by type of disability and change in type of disability over time. But we don't have any kind of hours of service by district measure that we could use.
Representative Vabin.
A follow-up, please. Also, you said that the billing from one district to another, are there guidelines for that billing, or is it something that's negotiated? And if one district feels that that amount that they are being assessed is unfair, is there an appeal process for that? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we changed this process a few years ago, and we went to what we call the uniform tuition billing model. And so the department has been doing some reviews and has some more uniformity in how those bills are being processed than before. So there's a little more regimentation in that, but it's still a pretty open system, I would say. And basically what happens is the resident district is on the hook for any unfunded costs. Now the costs have to be those that are approved for the IEP, and they have to be the costs that are eligible for special education funding. But nonetheless, those districts that have a lot of resident students getting special ed services in another district, one of their biggest concerns is those bills when they come back. And particularly if a child is placed in an expensive treatment program, for example, occasionally a district will have a child placed in another state in a program that may require 24-hour care, and those bills can be quite extensive. But the tuition billing, there is some uniformity and more uniformity in that now than there used to be, but there's still a wide variation depending on the cost of service. For example, because our special education formula is a salary reimbursement formula, if your special education student were in a district with very low salaries, the bill you'd get from them would be smaller than if they were in a district with very high salaries. And that's just a function of the way that reimbursed cost is determined.
Representative Fabian, is that it? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, oftentimes, I'm going to go back to special ed co-ops. Oftentimes in a special ed co-op, it's a regional kind of concept, and the largest school district in that co-op is usually the fiscal agent for the whole co-op. Is there any federal relief to those fiscal agents, those districts that choose to be fiscal agents for the special ed co-op, as far as maintenance of effort liability on their stand from their standpoint versus the other districts that they're the fiscal agent for?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cromie want to add to this as well. We've had a number of conversations. There are several models. A more common model is actually that the districts are in a co-op. But this fiscal, where one district is a fiscal host, that can be a real issue in terms of how the revenue looks for that district. I think the department's done a nice job of working on the maintenance of effort with that when a district's a fiscal host. I'm not aware of problems, maintenance of effort problems, because of a fiscal host arrangement. But the maintenance of effort issue comes up because the federal government essentially requires on special ed funding that there be a maintenance of effort, that you can't cut your special ed funding below the level of the previous year if you're serving the same number of students. But I'm not aware of any problems that fiscal hosts have with that. There may well be some. But yeah, we'll check with the department on that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Representative Ward, anything else?
Nope, thank you.
Representative Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, your reference to students being placed in other alternative settings and the cost burden to districts provoked the question of court order. If a child is being adjudicated and is, as part of that, is court ordered to a psychiatric treatment facility, something like that, who pays for the cost of Totem Town or wherever they may end up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the educational costs of that placement are built back to the resident district. So if a student from St. Paul were to be court-placed in a facility in Duluth, for example, that provides special ed and perhaps correctional services as well, the provider of that service, let's say it was the Duluth School District, would bill back to the St. Paul School District any unreimbursed special education costs for that student. So it's the resident district is the one on the hook for that unreimbursed special education costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Changing the scenario slightly, if the child voluntarily goes into, say, a residential chemical dependency treatment program, that would then, at least in the old days when I worked in similar settings, provide educational services. Who's paying for the educational services of that child while they're in the residential CD treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, if that child's got an IEP, then their special education costs are going to be billed back to the resident district. We actually had a bill in front of the committee last year concerning a treatment program in the Robbinsdale School District. I don't remember which member authored that bill last year, but it had to do with some non-IEP children being placed at a facility there where the school district essentially couldn't claim them for state aid but was providing services for them. That wasn't so much a billback issue as a lack of billback as they were students from other states that were placed at this facility. But generally speaking, if that child got an IEP, then the resident district is going to be, the Minnesota resident district is going to be on the hook for the unreimbursed costs of providing that educational.
One last question. The placement itself does not satisfy the requirements for an IEP. It would have to be a pre-existing disability that yielded an IEP.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for example, a student in a drug treatment program, if that student didn't have an underlying condition and wasn't there long enough for an IEP to be formed by that district, then that's correct. There would essentially have to be the service component for the bill back. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strong.
Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, we had actions last biennium where the federal government put in extra dollars for special education. Are those in our track in the diagram we're seeing here? And the second part of the question is, can you briefly discuss the maintenance of effort provisions of that? Can you just briefly talk about the money that came from Washington when it sunsets the cliff that's out there?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cromie, want to help me with this? My memory is a little bad on a bit of this, but if you look at the graph, if you look at fiscal years 10 and 11 are primarily the two where the additional federal money for special education is being recognized by districts. When federal funds come to the state, there's something called the Tidings Amendment at the federal government level that allows school districts a length of time in which to spend that money. There were some special provisions related to the maintenance of effort for the first couple of years, and I don't remember if it was 50% the first year. I'm drawing a blank on this. We'll have to dig out the memos on that. But there was a little bit of a window on that maintenance of effort for those federal funds. I'm drawing a blank here. I think it was 50% in the first year, and then there was a 15% window, I think, in the second. But we better double check that because I'm fuzzy on that. Yep. Yeah, we'll double check on that. I don't want to mislead you here, but there are going to be some issues if that federal level of funding, of course, disappears. Districts are going to be if they've got those built into staff costs in that federal. Funding is gone. They're gonna have some real issues. But we'll dig up the memos on that from last session.
And just so the committee understands, in addition to losing the money, the federal government's going to require that the previous expenditure levels that were temporarily subsidized will be the floor.
Sure.
They have to maintain the higher level even though the money didn't come. Correct?
Mr. Chair, essentially, yes.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always essentially, Mr. Strom, right? Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, that could be a real big issue.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We're going to be challenged by it. I'm wondering, I'm recalling a Supreme Court decision within the last year out east having to do with where there's contention about placement. And it was a big school. It might have even been New York or Boston school district that were challenging a placement out of a district. I'm vaguely recalling that the Supreme Court basically came down the side of the parent in terms of having supremacy, if you will, of placement in a special ed program. And so I'm just wondering, just generally, is Minnesota law pretty clear or very clear about the processes and who has, quote-unquote, supremacy relative to placement of a student when there is a contention between a district and a resident student?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I think I'm going to have to talk to some others. I'll talk with Ms. Larson and a few others about that issue. I'm not comfortable answering that with where we're at now.
Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, I'll follow up with Mr. Strom.
And Representative Mariani, I think the case you're citing, if it's the same one I'm thinking of, ultimately the student ended up going to a private institution.
I think that's right.
And the school district paid for it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the court said, you have to.
Right.
So that was a huge case and a possible preview of coming attractions. So, what else? Okay, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't get into this too much today, but we do have some issues about what we refer to as the unilateral placement of students in a non-public situation in Minnesota. But why don't if you don't mind, why don't we save this subject for another time? we'll get a pile of paper together for you on that, so we can better answer your questions on that.
And Mr. Strom, just one last question. In the area, I don't want to leave members with the false impression that we're anywhere near 100% for the reimbursement rates. But right now, the last numbers I saw, right about, what, 68% of 85%? Is that the number?
Yeah, I think that's about right, Mr. Okay. Chair. The way our special education formula works is we say, the state says it will reimburse a portion of the eligible expenses, and the eligible expenses basically consist of the salaries for the essential personnel that are providing the service. So the special education aides and teachers, 68% of that salary goes into the regular special education formula. And then that amount statewide is capped, and so if the total in the state is over that amount, which it is, then you're brought down to the cap. And so there's essentially the department doesn't like to use the word proration because it's a formula that does that, but it essentially prorates everybody down to the level that's in statute. And then we have a second formula called the excess cost formula, and that says for those districts with high special education costs, another portion of that cost is going to be covered. And that formula is also subject to a statewide cap and is prorated down so that the state total spending on special education is not over that amount. Yep. And I think that 85% of 68 is about the right percentage for where we are for the current year.
Okay. And for members of the committee, know that when we used to have money, how money is allocated at the state in these programs can have a dramatically different impact in your district. So, for example, back in 05 and 06 07 and 08, when the legislature allocated new funds for education, I won't use disproportionate because more money went into special education that went onto the general education formula. Mm-hmm. And there were certain members who went ballistic when they saw this, and there are certain other members who thought that was a good idea. Conversely, previous to that, when there was a cap on special education, there were widely different impacts on individual districts where, again, the people who were happy about the money going on special education and not on the general ed formula basically switched roles when there was a cap there. And it's just important for individual members to understand how, just like Plinko and The Price is Right, it's not where you pour it in on the top or even how much, it's where the channels go, and these things are all interactive. And it's very complex. Yay. So, any other questions for Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom? Please
Mr.
proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And as I said, we'll probably come back to the special education issues later this session. Mr. Crow is now going to talk about some general conditions of expenditure, staffing, and the financial condition of school districts.
And Mr. Chair and members, if you turn to page 40 of your handout, this kind of gets to what we talked about at the beginning, that generally we'll talk about revenue to school districts. We did want to include some expenditure data, but as you can see from the title of the chart, it's fiscal 09 data. So it's it's not as up-to-date as what we can give you on revenue data. So if you look at that, you can see from the size of the pie pieces how much districts are spending right now on various purposes. So obviously the biggest piece is regular instruction, and then the next biggest piece is special education. Between those two, that accounts for about 65% of school district spending. And then there's some other things that might be of interest to you, activities in athletics, administration, transportation. You can kind of see their relative size in proportion to total spending. If you look at the chart on page 41, from another kind of perspective, not what area are they spending it on, but within those areas, what are their costs, you can see that the bulk of the costs that school districts face are employee costs. About 77% of the money that districts spend is spent on salaries and benefits, and so and that's all employees within the district, and then everything else accounts for 22% of expenditures.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Crump, what is the classroom versus support staff pie chart look like?
Mr. Chair and members, you can see that there are pie pieces for support services. And so over on the left, you see that pupil support's about 3%, instructional support's about 5% of expenditures.
Follow up, please.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair. I'm specifically looking at staffing costs, classroom versus support. Functionality.
On the second chart, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. We don't have the breakdown here. Can we get it off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fong, one of the nice things about the school district accounting system is all expenditures are coded by program and then by object as well. And so what that means is we could take any program, for example, regular instruction, and then break that down by object and see the salaries for regular instruction. So if you'd like to see, and there's something called the School District Consolidated Financial Report, and that, I think, may break that just a little two-page report for each district and the state that's on the Department of Education's website. And that breakdown may be a little more helpful to you here in this context. That I think, breaks down the portions by a little bit by program and by object. But we can do that for you if you want to know what portion of regular instruction is salaries, or how the salaries in the regular instruction area compare to the salaries in the support area. That's a kind of breakdown that is possible with the UFARS data for school districts.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, if we could go back to the general fund percent of expenditures by program fiscal year 2009 chart. You know, that's regular instruction at 46%, special ed at 17%, career and technical instruction at 1%. Can you tell us how has that chart changed over the last decade, or has it changed over the last decade? For example, you know, I ended my career in a class more geared towards career and technical instructions, and I think we had a lot of those kind of programs available, vocational programs available, and I'm, you know, down to 1% now. Or support pupil support services, or can you tell us how has it changed, number one, and how has it changed over the last, let's say, decade?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, we'll dig that chart up for you. It's not too hard for us to find that, so we can dig that up for you pretty quick. My guess is that you're going to find two changes here. One, that special education expenditures level has just been growing over time. That's a decade ago, I'm sure that was smaller than 17% by several percentage points. In terms of the career and technical instruction, a couple of things have happened there in the last 30 years on that front. One of those is we used to have a categorical funding for career and technical instruction, and we used to require licensed instructors to teach those programs, and because of the way the funding system worked, if you had a high-cost program, which was often a program with a low level of per-pupil service, that program was eligible for more reimbursement. And we've gone away from that formula for career and technical instruction, and we've also changed the way that that people think about some of those career and technical programs. So some of those now show up, very similar kinds of programs might show up in that regular instruction category. My guess is that overall percentage in career and tech, even 10 years ago, is pretty close to the percentage it is now. Well, I can pop that chart up real quick for you here. That special education piece is the one that's growing the most. If you look at school district and school administration lines, those two administrative lines at the top, the district ones, superintendent and all of the central office, the school administrative lines, the principal and the line staff there, the other staff there at the building, those expenditures haven't changed much in the last 10 years. So I'm guessing that the biggest change you'll see is that special education pie is a fair amount bigger.
Okay. One follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Ward.
Thank you. How about transportation? Has that remained pretty stable at 5% of the pie usually for our school districts in the state, all school districts in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, my guess is we had a big change away from a categorical funding system for pupil transportation back in 1997. So my guess is if you go 10 years back, you're probably not going to find too much difference on that transportation percentage. I'll just double-check these here when Mr. Crow's distracting you, and we can tell you what these percentages are. So that you have a sense of that. But I don't think it's gone down. I'm sure it's gone down, but probably not by more than a percentage point over the last 10 years.
Thank you very much. Mr. Crow is a great distractor for all of us.
And good questions. Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Ward asked the question I was going to ask, but I do want to make a quick observation. And I think these are appropriate questions to ask. But, you know, I run a nonprofit organization. We've been doing it for over 10 years, and our funding sources will basically okay administrative operational costs in the 15% range. We're actually closer to 10% in the nonprofit that I run. And this morning I was at a session where we heard from testifiers at the session over at the Capitol that some insurance, health insurance companies, not here, but in other states, are running 20% administrative costs. So I think one of the things that's important for us to do is to also compare, what these costs stack up in terms of other sectors and in other regions of the country. And this is just, knee-jerk, but, 4% district admins, 4% school administration looks like a pretty good deal. I wish I could run my nonprofit at 4%, but we just can't. And so I think we're getting a pretty good bang for the buck in that regard. I know that districts are very sensitive to this issue of making sure that the bulk of their resources are going into classroom instruction, because at the end of the day, that's really what it's all about.
And Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick question. Would computers and computer labs, would that fall under capital expenditure or career and technical instruction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, if the school is spending its money on a computer, that should be in the cap. I would guess that that's in the capital expenditure. School districts can use a non-capital money for something like computers. That shouldn't be in the career and technical area unless, for example, it were equipment for a drafting class or something like that. But general computers for the school are gonna show up outside of that career and technical area, and are likely. I guess I'm not quite sure where the district's gonna code that expenditure, because they can use their regular undesignated general fund money for buying computers, or they can use their capital money for buying that. But unless it's like specialized drafting equipment or computers special to the mechanic shop, it's not going to show up in the career and technical area.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schramm, do you know where, or can you explain where the parochial school students fit into the formula as far as how they're counted as pupils and how that funding works as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, in Minnesota, we use a definition of resident pupil units for some things, but that definition of resident pupil is essentially all pupils who reside in a district that attend a public school, including a charter school, and does not include a count of non-public or homeschool students. So in Minnesota, in virtually none of our pupil count formulas do those students show up in the pupil counts. And so as a result, the places where the funding for the non-public and homeschool students comes are in the areas where we've got categorical funding formulas that extend to those organizations. And some of those are, we do have special education funding that goes to non-public students. We have a couple of state formulas. We have a state requirement for what we call the equal treatment statute, which requires school districts to provide the same treatment for student transportation to their non-public kids as their public kids. So, for example, if a school district buses everyone who lives more than 2 miles from school to the public school that they attend, they need to provide that same service to the non-public students as well. And then the other formula that we have is we do have a non-public pupil aid formula that's money that's passed through the school district to the non-publics, and that's for textbooks, guidance, and counseling. And that, I think the total of that, it's in the guidebook. I think that's in the $280 range or thereabouts, or $250 range. We'll dig that number up here for you. But essentially, outside of those formulas, we just don't we don't count those students unless they're coming to a public school. We do have a program called Shared Time, where a student who's in the school for a part of the day gets counted. But whether that's counting them as a non-public student part-time as a public student or as a public student for the time they're there is sort of an argument of phraseology or word argument on that. So those are the main ways that we count them, but we don't ever take them into account for our, like, the referendum or our funding on a basic per pupil amount.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Any other questions, Representative Ward?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, comments and questions speared another one in mine as his comments. In the past couple of years, we've seen some bills around the Capitol regarding percent of funding going right directly into the classroom, and bills that are saying, okay, we need to get whatever percent into the classroom. Can you tell us, how much are we? What percent of the dollars are going directly into the classroom, direct instruction to the students, and has that changed over the last decade as well, or how are we doing on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, about 6 or 8 years ago, I think there was a lot of focus on a 70% number or 65% number going to the classroom, and it has to do in our accounting system. It have to do with which of these other categories over here you would include as classroom. We have this 46% as regular instructional expenditure, as well as 17% for special education. I presume you'd throw career and tech in there. I presume that the student activities and athletics would not be in there. Much trickier for the instructional support and the pupil support, whether particularly on the instructional support, whether that would be considered classroom spending or not. But so if one wanted to come up on our accounting system with a number like that, it's really just a question of definitionally would one want instructional support in there or not. And as I said earlier, my guess is that these numbers haven't changed a whole lot, with the exception that the purple pie for special education has grown over the last 10 years. But my guess is that those other pies, that and the regular instruction, have probably shown the most variation to cancel each other out. The other things, like district administration, hasn't really changed much over time. And as I said earlier, I don't think the transportation has gone down much in the last 10 years.
Thank you.
Okay, carry on, Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroll.
Mr. Chair and members, then I think we're on page 42. Kind of in there as background for you all to just see what's happened to student-teacher ratios over time. As you can see, for the past 10 years or so, it's been pretty flat. The top line is excluding special ed, and because special ed services are generally significantly lower. It's fewer number of pupils, but significantly lower pupil teacher ratios. That drives the average, including special ed, down significantly, comparing what it is for regular instruction. Then on page 43, and this gets a little bit at, I think it was Representative Plum yesterday asked about cash flows and shifts as they relate to districts and fund balances and SOD. As you can see, on a statewide basis, over the last 10 years, School district charter school fund balances have gone up pretty significantly as a percentage of their expenditures, and we can give you this information on a per school basis or on a per pupil basis. You can kind of see what, how much districts are holding at the end of the previous fiscal year. We can get this data. So for example, we'll get the data as of June 30th, 2010, is as recent as we would have it. But basically, you can see that it's gone, you know, obviously from 8% up to about 14.5%. And then kind of the converse of that is slide 44, the number or the percent of school districts and charter schools that are in statutory operating debt. We define statutory operating debt as an operating deficit that's greater than 2.5% of their expenditures. So in other words, they're more than 2.5% in the hole during a given fiscal year. And so as you can see, that number of districts and charter schools has fallen significantly over time. And the top line is actually the districts that percent of districts with a negative fund balance. And some of those districts, if they're not up to a negative 2.5%, they aren't technically in statutory operating debt, but they're running in an annual operating deficit. And that line is even more dramatic in the decline of districts that are running annual deficits as you go from 2000 to 2009 in the past 10 years or so.
One more. Representative Dietrich, you had a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go back to that pupil-teacher ratio. So what is, where are we getting these numbers from? From my simplistic thinking, I would say pupil to teacher ratio, that might mean something like class size. And I'm just so confused by that because I go into my public schools and we don't have a class in the district that I think is 19 kids.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, the number that we're using for teachers is the number of people in the school district that hold a teacher license, and so they may not be a classroom teacher. For example, you can see that the difference between, if you just exclude those that are special education teachers, makes a pretty substantial district. But all of the curriculum specialists and other folks in the school system that hold a teacher license go into that measure as well. So if you take all of those folks, everyone within that system with a license, and divide the number of pupils by that, this is the number you'll come up with statewide.
Representative Dietrich.
That was going to be my follow-up. Statewide. Boy, and what is the value of this chart? I mean, what does that demonstrate to us? What message to the public does this send, and to us as policymakers? I'm just really confused as to what, is it just how many... Well, you tell me.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, a number of the things that Mr. Crow and I have included in our graphs are designed to get you to think about these issues.
This
is the perfect example.
But
I think it really, from a policy perspective here at the state legislature, it begs the question, in general, I think most of our school districts have many people that are curriculum specialists that work on staff development, that work on all sorts of issues where we've said that here are some ways that we can help improve instruction without putting in an extra body in a classroom for additional classroom instruction. Now, we also have variation amongst districts, and so that matters as well. We can look at these pupil-teacher ratios on a district-by-district basis using this measurement. But I think the questions that people need to think about are, well, do curriculum specialists make sense, or should they all be classroom teachers? Very good questions. Currently, essentially, we're having local school boards make those decisions. The state isn't forcing anyone to have a curriculum specialist or not. But essentially, this is a measure of pupils divided by the licensed teachers in statewide. So all the students over all the licensed teachers.
Representative
Mr. Chair, apologize.
To that point, Representative Bills, or can you?
Yes.
To that point, Representative Bills.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dietrich, I might be able to help you out, as well as the other classroom teachers that sit on the committee. Is that I in a 7-period day, I teach 5 hours. I have a duty and then a prep. So if I'm just teaching my, you know, when you think about, oh my goodness, you know, you walk into a classroom and there's 35, 36 kids. but yet you look at the chart and you see 15, you know, or whatever the top number is.
19.
Okay, so when I'm off at my duty or my prep, where do all those other children go? And it's into someone else's classroom to be educated in math, science, English, whatever. If I look to Representative Fabian, Representative Ward, does that help to explain? Because I think that's why you might be slightly confused as to why you walk into your schools and you see a classroom full of kids and yet you see a 19.1 number up there. I don't know if any other representatives who have taught could speak to that, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slocum, Fabian, or Ward, Representative Slocum?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. Denise, we should talk about this. They're what we label the teachers who don't teach.
And there's that.
And there are many that are in this number that are being counted as teachers who do teach, and they don't. They don't have student contact. It's something that should be discussed and looked at closely, I think, especially given our budget.
Representative Slocum, maybe we got a bill introduction coming, huh? Representative Fabian or Ward, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I look at these numbers and I think, boy, I'd love to have 19 students in my health class.
I'd love to have my children.
But it doesn't work that way.
To that point.
There's a lot of numbers that are involved in this stuff, and we don't have any teachers in Rosa that don't teach, I can tell you that. So, you know, it depends upon where you come from. Just a little editorial note, we do a great job in Rosa of educating our students, and I'm very, very proud of our staff and our administration and our students. Thank you.
All right. And members, just so you know, I'm going to allow this to go forward to this point. We're letting people kind of bump to the front of the line. But when we have bills coming forward, we're not going to be doing this. I mean, this is what happens in our caucus since I've been here. People say to that point, it's a way to get to the front of the line, but we're having a casual conversation. So Representative Reinhart, to that point.
Mr. Chair, I apologize to anybody if I bumped any other member from their point, but
Representative Reinhart, you can arm wrestle Representative Mariani over it. So,
well, I would just be a little cautious about over-determining what implications this chart has, and what I would suggest is if you have concerns in this area, you speak to your own school district or districts about this distribution, because, you know, as has already been indicated, this will vary dramatically from district to district. And the role of teachers who hold licenses who may not be assigned to a classroom, again, is dramatically different, partly on the basis of whether schools are involved in QCOMP or not, and how they're staffing those positions that are paid for through QCOMP that involve curriculum planning or staff evaluation and so forth. So ask in your own district about how this ratio compares to class size, and don't overgeneralize from this chart, because I think the variation is too great.
Representative Kelly.
I was just curious, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, do you have these statistics per district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, yes, the Department of Education does an annual publication that's on their website called School District Financial Profiles. And that includes spending information, revenue information, and then some general demographic characteristics, including this measure. So you can look for individual districts and see. And as others have mentioned here, I think none of you are going to see your classroom size there. You're going to see a measure of students divided by licensed teachers. But you'll see that there's a lot of variation in that number from district to district when you look at the school district financial profiles.
Thank you.
Representative Plow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to this chart, having been a school board member, and we went to the voters with a levy to decrease the class size, and knowing many parents go to the site, look at this information when they're choosing schools, and that the state has in the past provided funds to decrease the class size, you know, it is disconcerting that the books are somewhat cooked when you play the games, you know, and that's why classroom versus non-classroom. And I'm very proud of the many districts that do, you know, put their money in the classroom. And I think that if we do have a program that is going to try and decrease class size, that we make sure we've got a metric that actually looks at the class size and takes away the teachers that aren't teaching. It only counts the instructional teachers when calculating this formula.
I had a bill like that one.
And Representative Quam, it's also it's a good point to have overall, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and members, one thing I just point out is that if we hadn't put a number on there, that shape of that line is also has some value to you as well. And you know, and if that number is, you know, 10 students higher, that it actually goes to Representative Quam was just talking about, that in the late 90s the legislature made a conscious effort, and we talked about it when we were talking about pupil weighting, made a conscious effort to drive more money to the lower grades to reduce class sizes. And so you see some reflection of that in that shape of that line. And then it's also important to note that that most of what happens with licensed teachers outside of the classroom is probably more on the margin than the majority of teachers. And so that flat projection is probably, whether it's 19 or 29, is probably a pretty good reflection of what's happening in terms of student-teacher ratios. And maybe something that, as you're talking about what's happened to funding for schools, that you need to consider as you think about, well, what's happening in schools when we change funding levels. Are schools doing a good job or a bad job of keeping student-teacher ratios the same in the classroom? And so a chart like this, even if the number is wrong, kind of gives you a sense that districts have over the past 10 years or 9 years after that initial class size money was put in, kept pupil-teacher ratios relatively constant over that time.
And, Mr. Crow, I guess the 2 points I was going to make is, one, I do think financially we can expect this committee will be discussing ways that we can direct those dollars to the classroom, and different strategies and different ideas to focus on that. But then also just an overall conversation, if you use the 19 number, assume that it's 19 and you want to drive it down to 15, this is really expensive. This costs a lot of money. You're talking about, if you want to go from 19 to 15, you're talking about a 26.7% increase in expenditures. And if we have those sorts of resources, would this necessarily be the best way to allocate a 26% increase in budgeting? That's a conversation that the education reform and the education finance committees can talk about, is about what are these things that have happened in the past and what does work. Representative Mariani, you're on the list.
Yes, and I'm pushing buttons on my phone without knowing it. well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Strom, Mr. Close, so let me, I'll move now to 44 where you left off. And so you're making me ask and think. And ask, so the big question I have is, and I know there's no simple answer to any of these things. You know, you're looking at districts with negative fund balances and statutory operating debt, and you know, to some degree, there's apples and oranges. It's different. You know, school districts have faced different circumstances. However, when I see something like a 3-year period of time between 97 and 2000, where negative fund balance districts almost, well, they're more than doubled, 7.8% to 17%, and then followed by a 4-year period of time where it dramatically drops, and a similar pattern with standard operating districts. It tells me there's a story there during that period of time, and I know there's no simple answer to it, but what are the salient things that happened between 97 and 2000? And then what are the salient things that happened between 2000 and 2004 that one can reasonably argue had a big impact on
this? Mr. Brown, Mr. Trump.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, that's a real good question. One thing I always keep in mind is when we're dealing with relatively small numbers, you know, a change of 5 or 6 school districts going below zero may make a few percentage point difference when we've got 300 or so school districts, 330 school districts in the state. So I always keep in mind that, you know, relatively small number of school districts can affect a metric like this. We have a number of very small school districts in this state. A chart like this would not reflect whether it's Black Duck or Minneapolis that was going into the red or not. I'd say that there's a couple of trends in my estimation that came into play with this. One of which is districts have higher costs as they get to be more mature. Teachers advance on a step and lane system, and regardless of whether you have an alternative compensation system or not, generally speaking, you're going to find the teachers that are there the longest are the ones that are the most expensive. for the school. The school may be getting very good value out of that, but teachers have maturity cycles. Schools have maturity cycles. So some schools in the late 90s, my guess is that a number of schools were at the top of that maturity cycle. They had a lot of teachers with 30 years of experience or 32 years of experience. And as those teachers started retiring and things, they could hire teachers in at the bottom of the salary schedule. So, and I know for a number of districts, that was sort of the peak of maturity, was around 2000 for a whole variety of reasons. So there may very well have been some extra costs that were facing districts just before they had some rounds of retirement. The second thing that's happening here that's washed out a little bit like this is if you compare this chart to the enrollment charts on the previous pages, you may see that the enrollment declines were still continuing in some of these districts and that those declines softened a bit afterwards. My guess would be, first, that the maturity of the teaching staff changed in these districts, and second, that there were some enrollment changes in rate of change in enrollment that were going on. But it's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chair and members, the other thing that comes into play here is kind of the swing in charter school finances. And if you look at the SOD report, a higher percentage of charter schools were in SOD or had negative fund balances as a percentage of all charter schools versus school districts. You know, in a given year, there might have been a dozen districts and charters in SOD, and four or five of them were districts, seven or eight of them were charter schools. And so and part of that is as they're new and they're trying to, you know, make sure they're you know, if their populations are going up and down, they might go negative because they weren't good at counting their pupils yet. So the beginning of this chart is when there was a lot of growth in the number of charter schools, and I suspect that comes into play because, as Mr. Strom says, with a small number, you know, if you add two or three charter schools to that list, it's going to make a significant change for that year. And if you're adding a bunch of charter schools every year and those two or three kind of things get better for them, but then you add two or three more or four or five more if there's big growth that year, that can drive some of this as well.
And Mr. Chair, members, there's one other thing I'd mention too. If you go back to the previous graph, the other thing that's gone on is school district fund balances have gotten healthier over time. And part of this, I think, there are some long-term things to think about here. Up until the early 90s, for about 20 years, up until the early 90s, Minnesota's school funding formulas had a penalty for school districts with large fund balances. The state actually would take money away from a school district if it had a large fund balance. And the rationale behind that was legislators were, in the early 80s particularly, were particularly adamant that if they fought here at the legislature to get more money for the schools, they didn't want to go home and have the school board tell them, well, thanks, we improved our fund balance with that. They wanted them to turn around and spend that money. And so I think a number of school districts would tell you from a fund balance perspective is that they felt it was just easier to run a lower fund balance, but that really they needed a fund balance in order to protect against emergency. And a lot of school districts, I think, have taken a more prudent view toward their fund balance over time. And if you think about what that number means, you know, if you're a school district with 8% reserves, is that really sufficient to cushion you should you have a major catastrophe in your district, if the boilers all went out at once or some other thing were to happen? And my guess is that if you're to look at this chart on page 43, that those fund balances won't be continuing to increase much above the level that they're at now, and that they'll probably stabilize more in that area. But I'm guessing most business managers would tell you that 8% cushion was on average way too low.
And Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, before we go to member questions, does that complete your presentation to us today?
Mr. Chair, we had about four other things we wanted to talk about, but we can certainly put that off to another time or can do it really quickly, depending on your preference.
Okay, well, let's take these questions quickly, and then we'll see if we can get through that. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious to know, from an accounting standpoint, what is the percentage of budget that should be in reserve?
Mr. Trump.
Mr. Chair, members, I think it would in some ways depend on the size of the district. If you're a very small district, if I were a business manager in a very small district, I'd want a larger fund balance because a boiler still is going to cost me $100,000 whether I've got 100 kids in the district or 1,000 kids in the district. So I would think that the smallest districts would want the largest fund balances. I'm not sure what a prudent number would be. That's a good question. I don't know. Often you hear, 1 month of reserve for every 6 months or something, so a 16% fund balance maybe would be a way. But we'll do a little checking on that with some of our business manager contacts and see if they have a number for us.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at this chart, and I'm wondering about the interaction between the fund balance chart and the state's accessing of fund balances for its cash flow. How did that line up? Is this reflective of the state's accessing? Is it not? Would it be different if it was? Help me with that, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, remember that accessing a fund balance happens within a fiscal year, and then these calculations are June 30th calculations. So if the state took all of the fund balance in September and then paid it all back in May, it wouldn't show up as a change on this chart, because on June 30th, they've got the same amount that they had. You know, obviously, realistically, if the state did that, they would be be borrowing, and they're you know, they might have to they might spend down into their fund balance for cash flow reasons, basically. But in effect, since it's a snapshot, and June 30th of 2010, it's here. The state takes it all away, pays it back. And June 30th, 2011, it's in the exact same spot.
And it is a fund balance, not a cash balance either. Mm-hmm. Remember that it's the school district. They've recognized that revenue that the state is not paying them in the shift. They've recognized that on their books. So they're counting that 30% that they're being owed right now in their fund balance, because it's their fund balance, not their cash balance. So you may see a different picture if it's their cash balance. But this is, you know, they've got accrual books. This is their fund balance that you're looking at there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following you up until the end there, Mr. Strom. So I want to call it fictional money. How much of this then? Phantom. Thank you. That's actually the word I was looking for. It's good to sit next to an English teacher. How much of this then is phantom? Is recognized money that doesn't actually exist?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, for one, this chart's only through 2009, so we haven't hit the first year that the enhanced shift is there yet. But remember that this is, because it's fund balance, it's recognizing their accounts receivable and their accounts payable and saying, what's our fund balance, not what's our cash balance. Right. So it doesn't really matter. The only thing that matters is they've incurred some expense. If they're a school district, they've incurred some relatively small expense to borrow for their cash flow purposes. So they're going to have additional expenses, you know, on that side of their ledger for the borrowing. But the fact that the state has shifted a bunch of their payments doesn't mean that they've lost 30% of their fund balance. It means on their cash balance they're tighter, but their fund balance is reflecting that. They're presuming the state's going to pay them that 30% back.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, even if we didn't institute a change in the shift, if we were at 90-10, their fund balance is still going to pick up the 10% from the previous year, so it's you know, fantasy money in that sense, you know, that they haven't actually collected the payments yet. I mean, that's what accrual accounting does. But at the same time, from a real money standpoint, they are collecting their 10% from the previous year in that current year. So they're, you know, if their entitlement is roughly the same, they're going to have basically the same amount of cash on hand as their accrued fund balance. It's only when that shift is instituted that they get that they have a cash flow issue where there is a fiscal year where they're recognizing significantly more revenue than they're actually collecting in checks from the state. But then even once that happens in the next year, they get the big 30% payment from the state. So then there's an influx of cash in the second year of the shift, for example, of money that they so that, you know, we get back to that 100% level on that chart I showed you earlier. So even in the real money, once you get past that first year in the real money versus fantasy money calculation, it's about the same. They're collecting, granted it's for the previous year, but they're collecting in cash that same amount of money after that first year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen.
Representative Bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Mr. Strom, on page 40, I had made this note and wanted to come back. Could I put a number with the fiscal year 2009 just to, could you throw that, I don't know if you have that necessarily stored.
About, you mean about how much that total is?
Yes.
Was?
Yes.
You know, it's a little under $10 billion, I think, in fiscal year 9.
Okay.
I don't have that right in front of me, but my guess is it's right around there.
That's good enough. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And now, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just going back to the cash balance. So really, if you combine the 2 years, the cash balance should actually be this balance. The phantom money would only be for that gap where you'd have the either a 10% split or a 30% split, right?
Mr. Chair,
or a 30% shift.
Representative Kelly, that's true to the extent that there's not, you know, interest costs,
right.
Lost interest from fund balances that are being spent or loan borrowing costs that districts are experiencing, and it's if your entitlement is growing, then you're in a, you know, if you're expecting to get $100 million 1 year and $120 million the next year, then when you're paying 70% of $100 in the second year, you're expecting $120, but you're getting 70% of $120 and 30% of the $100 you got the previous year. There's a gap there as well, but generally, yeah.
Representative Kelly?
No, Mr. Chair, I guess that's what I was saying. It should only be that 1 year's time period, though. The following year we should be caught up as we pay that back from a cash balance standpoint.
And Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom,
thank
I
you.
Think we're going to finish it right there. We're not going to move on to the next topic. But just brief, maybe something we can talk about in the future is for members to understand how now with OPEB liability, those costs are actually being accounted for now under some mechanisms, but on other ones are not. And so we've kind of seen an example here of the different types of accounting with regards to revenue. But on the expenditure side, there's dramatic consequences because of GASB 45. And we could talk about that a little bit later. But I do know that there's going to be the majority party is going to be caucusing at 2:30. And we want to make sure everyone's on time for that, unless there's any other discussions from members. Oh, Representative Dietrich, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make one general point, and that is, and I don't expect people to go back, but on page 6 of this presentation, where the money goes in the whole state budget, it points out that in K-12 education, it is 43% of the budget. I have been in so many circles here at the beginning of, because of the beginning of sessions, where people are making statements that it is half of the state budget. And so, and I've even heard people say over half of the state budget. So I think that just to be on record, and all of us understand that K-12 education, at least according to this slide, is 43% of the state budget.
And Representative Dietrich, even that number is pretty high, because Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom could tell me, but I believe that the payback of the shift is built into that number. So it's even, my guess is the true number, if there is such a thing in education finance, is probably about 39 or 39 and a half. But maybe I'm wrong. Representative Mariani.
Just a quick question. These are great materials. Are we done with them, or should we leave them in a packet? Or
you know, Representative Mariani, I'd suggest that members just put them in their save folder, and we'll address that, because there is good materials, and we might actually be referencing them later in session.
Good.
So it'd be good. Any other questions or comments? With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.